From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, this is Newsmakers. I'm Maureen McCollum. The Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, and Transgender Resource Center in downtown La Crosse is facing a financial crisis. This week, it had to essentially lay off its executive director, Roseanne St. Sauver, because it doesn't have the money to pay her. The Seven Rivers Region Center will have to cut back hours and rely heavily on volunteers to staff the center and oversee teen and adult groups that meet there. I talked with LGBT Resource Center Board President Cindy Killian earlier this week.
We're the only kind of resource center probably in the four-state region that serves a largely rural population. I don't know. I'm a founding mother, so I helped get this thing off the ground in 2004. You know, the whole point was that we needed a central location that was safe for LGBT people to network, get to know themselves in the community, and then provide outreach to the larger community. You know, the center is used pretty regularly by different groups that meet there. That's the issue for me at this point, is how do we continue offering at least a safe space for people.
So how much money do you need per month or annually in order to fully operate, and how far away are you from that monetary goal?
Well, last year our budget, we spent about $60,000. We only have about a sixth of that right now. So we've been more aggressive, and what we're going to do is develop a strategic funding plan that would include grants, you know, memberships. Do we try to do sustaining membership? We also want to develop a more sustainable volunteer base. You know, we're going to do our best to continue doing our basic stuff and hope that this is a turning point for us and we can start building on it. A lot of it depends on finances and, you know, what do? If you don't have money to pay the rent, then you got hard decisions to make.
Cindy Killian is the board president of the LGBT Resource Center of the Seven Rivers Region in La Crosse, which had to lay off its executive director since it hasn't been able to raise enough money. Gary Hollander is the executive director of Diverse and Resilient, an LGBT-focused Milwaukee nonprofit. He says many LGBT community and resource centers are facing similar situations across the country. He says it traces back to the business models the centers were built upon.
Many times community centers are born out of the need experienced by the lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people in a community, whether it's a large city, a neighborhood within a city, or a smaller city or town. But they don't really contemplate where they're going to go for resources to keep it going, and is it possible to keep it going without full-time staff. And generally, it's very difficult, really challenging, to have a center survive in cities, I would say, of less than a half million people.
So a place like La Crosse.
Yes. It would be very challenging. And in part, it would be challenging because I don't quite know where the donors are going to come to keep a community center open. It provides valuable resources not only to the LGBT people in the community, but also to other agencies and neighborhoods who need to understand and support the LGBT people in their lives. And so a community center and a resource center can provide that to a local college or university. It can provide those services to congregations and to families. But unless there's a fee for those services, the model doesn't really allow for it to be sustained.
In larger cities like Milwaukee or Madison, is the population just there to sustain these centers, or is there other issues going on?
Well, there are a couple of issues. One of them is there's a large enough community. So, for example, in a city like Milwaukee, there are approximately 60,000 LGBT people in the greater Milwaukee area. In the Seven Rivers region, there's probably, 20% of that number. Well, when you look at 12,000 people, each one of them would need to be, probably spending $100 to $200 a year to keep that organization going in a really robust way where it starts to significantly meet the needs of the community. And I'm not confident that that support is there. There's also large cities like Seattle, Washington, that has not been able to sustain an LGBT community center. And in part there, it's a different issue as the LGBT people in Seattle have become more assimilated into mainstream society. They are themselves perceiving less need for a community or resource center.
Do you want to talk about the importance of local service centers, especially for maybe more smaller rural communities?
Resource centers and community centers and those services are vitally important in smaller communities, in part because the general structure of supports for people in smaller communities are already fragile. So, for example, I'm sure that there are other long-term nonprofits in La Crosse that are struggling each year, and they're already at capacity to provide the needs, for example, to Native American people or to women or to youth. And when you have another population like LGBT people, that's not going to be the highest priority in these times of dwindling resources in these other organizations. In addition to that, there are problems that LGBT youth face, for example, in school, and they face them at the university, and they may face them in their neighborhoods. And if, in the absence of a robust program, those existing institutions don't necessarily pick up the slack. And so young people and their families are forced then to go to websites and to national organizations. And the national organizations can do advice giving, you know, and they can do some emailing and some phone calls. But basically, you know, what's going to happen at the community level? So, for example, if you have a suicidal teen who's being bullied in school and you call the Trevor Project, which is in Los Angeles, what good is that going to do you in La Crosse?
Gary Hollander is the executive director of Diverse and Resilient, an LGBT-focused Milwaukee nonprofit. You're listening to Newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, I'm Maureen McCollum. It's okay to talk about bullying today and the negative impact it can have on children as they grow up. Back in 1996, that wasn't the case when Jamie Nabuzny sued the Ashland School District in northern Wisconsin for ignoring the bullying he was subjected to in middle and high school. He won, helping to hold school administrators more accountable for providing a safe education for all. Bullying is still a major issue in schools. But because of stories and the work of people like Nabuzny, many more students have the tools to fight bullying when they encounter it. Nabuzny spoke last spring at UW La Crosse. We talked about his story.
For me, the harassment started in seventh grade, and like for most kids, it started with verbal harassment. Kids were calling me fag, queer, those types of things. And the harassment escalated when the administrators chose to do nothing. My middle school principal said things like, boys will be boys. If I was going to be openly gay, I had to expect this kind of stuff. And whenever anybody gives kind of that green light that what's happening is okay when it's verbal harassment, it obviously will escalate because the further you dehumanize someone and push them in that direction, the easier it is to do worse and worse things. And so the violence escalated throughout my middle and high school until the last beating that actually put me in the hospital and required me to have surgery.
It got to that point.
Absolutely. I've been hospitalized seven times because of the harassment and physical violence that's happened to me.
And these are children that you grew up with, classmates of yours, and I'm assuming maybe the same people all along those years that were doing the bullying?
Mostly it was the same people that were harassing me, especially in junior high and high school. I didn't really have that many issues in grade school, but I wasn't in Ashland in grade school. My family had moved around a lot when I was young.
So eventually you decided to sue the school administration. Can you talk about that and why it was so groundbreaking for its time?
originally I had decided to bring a lawsuit against my school district, and a local attorney in Minneapolis actually had brought the case, and it was thrown out of federal court for lack of precedent, which is why people bring cases to begin with, but that's besides the point. And the case only continued because Lambda Legal out of New York took on the appeal, and we won the appeal, which let us have the right to go to trial, and then eventually we had a jury decision that came down that the three principals of my school were found guilty of discriminating against me and not protecting me from harassment. And it was groundbreaking because it was the first time, period, that a court had said that a school was liable for what happened to students in school. So it was probably assumed by most people that schools were there to protect kids. But in reality, the law said nothing about schools protecting kids. And my case established for the first time that schools had to protect students from harassment. And even though, even if they're gay, lesbian, bisexual, or transgender, they still have to protect them, and they have that same responsibility.
And how old were you when you decided that you'd move forward with this lawsuit?
When the lawsuit began, I was 17 years old, and it was 1993, and the lawsuit actually concluded pretty quickly, and it was 96 when the trial happened.
And then were you able to sue based on the one incident that sent you to the hospital, or was it every action that happened over your childhood?
My lawsuit was a cumulative of all of the harassment that started in the 7th grade, actually, and went through the 11th grade when I left.
Since that lawsuit and since they established that children do deserve safe school environments, have things changed within school districts, not only in Ashland, not only in Wisconsin, but across the country?
Some places have changed, and some places have changed dramatically. I mean, I'm amazed as I travel around and I see schools have gay-straight alliances in middle schools with 50 kids. And so there's a lot of places where things have changed, but unfortunately, there's a lot of places where things have not changed as well.
And can you talk about that? I mean, places that haven't changed, what are they not doing?
I think that it's still similar to what happened to me, is that administrators decide because of their own personal biases and bigotries about homosexuality and gender identity that they will not choose to protect the students who are gay, lesbian, bisexual, or transgender. And depending on the severity and depending on the environment, it has been to the extreme that happened to me. There was a young man that contacted me who grew up in Oklahoma, and he's now a senior in school. But when he contacted me, his mom and him had left this small town because he'd gotten harassed throughout his whole school career, middle school or grade school, middle school, and high school. And the last beating that he suffered, kids actually put rocks in plastic bags and beat him with it. He had a concussion. He had the bone around his eye socket was broken, lots of cuts, bruises, and he was in the hospital for 3 days. And at that point, his mom knew that they would kill him if she let him go back to the school. So she chose to leave her husband, who wasn't willing to leave, and take him and move to Fort Worth, Texas, where she actually read in the newspaper that there was a gay-straight alliance there and felt he would be safe. And so there's absolutely things still happening like what happened to me. And even, you know, a lot of people say, well, it happens to me, but it was just verbal. It wasn't that bad. Well, I'll tell you, the verbal harassment is much more damaging, and long-term damage from that is much more severe than the physical. I don't know. I can't remember what it was like to be physically beaten, but I remember to this day the words they called me and how I felt from those words.
You know, administrators gave the excuse, kids will be kids, boys will be boys, but, I mean, that's not an excuse. And do you think people have learned or are thinking about that more?
I think administrators are definitely aware of the issue of bullying and are choosing, hopefully, to address it. And, you know, and I think most people get into education because they care about kids and they want kids to learn and be safe. Unfortunately, there's people that are in education maybe not for the right reasons or that are in education but only feel like that protection or that education should go to specific children. And it's not just GLBT kids. I mean, there's other kids. My personal experience in my school was we're right next to a reservation. And my middle school principal had a huge issue with the Native American kids. And there was actually at one point money that was to be donated for a Native American cultural center in my middle school. And she rejected it because there was no white cultural center. I mean, that was her actual reasoning for it. And when you've got kids that are, you know, have high poverty rates, high rates of depression, suicide, drug and alcohol abuse, and you don't want to include them in the conversation and you don't want to have a cultural center to let them know, not just let them know kind of their roots, but let the rest of the school understand where these kids come from and what kind of background they have. It was really sad. And so it wasn't, like I said, for me, it was the issue that I was gay. But for other students, she just decided that there was only certain kids worthy of protection or worthy of the education that she wanted to give.
And you've taken your experience and this lawsuit and you're traveling to different school districts just to talk with kids about your life and about bullying. Why did you first decide to start doing that?
Well, I was approached to make the film. It was about 3 years ago.
The film Bullied.
The film Bullied, correct. And originally, it took me a little while to say yes because I had established myself in a very different place. I was working for Wells Fargo, and for a long time, I was tired of being the kid who got beat up from Wisconsin. I wanted to prove myself in a different way. And then, you know, I knew that things were still not great. I knew that things hadn't changed in a lot of places, and I wanted to make the film in a way to help those kids that were still being bullied. And it was interesting because once the film came out and I started getting public speaking requests and I started speaking publicly, I realized that it really wasn't the kids who were being bullied that I wanted to reach, and it wasn't the kids who were doing the bullying. It was the bystanders. You know, most of the kids in schools are not being bullied. They're not the bullies, but they're the kids sitting there watching this and wishing it was different. And I know for me, most of the apologies I've received were from those kids who felt guilty that they didn't do anything. And my message to kids is that they not only have an ability, but they have a responsibility to stand up when things are happening. That if they're standing by silently and not doing anything when other kids are harassing and bullying other kids, they're just as responsible for that harassment as the kids doing the bullying.
So when you give a presentation to middle school students, to high mm-hmm. school students, talking to younger people can't always be easy. What do you say to them? How do you convince them that even just being an innocent bystander isn't acceptable?
What I do in my school presentations is they, first of all, they see the film Bullied. And I think they get where I'm coming from. But then I ask them questions like, why do you think students bully other students? And I ask them if there's a difference between somebody saying that's so gay, for example, and calling somebody a faggot. And I get them to think about these issues in a little bit different way. And then I let them know that they really are the only ones that have anything to do with this. I don't think we can pass federal laws. We can pass state laws. We can pass all the policies we want. We can do all of these things. But unless students own this issue and decide they want to tackle this issue, schools will not be safe for kids, period. And I think they get that. I mean, and one of the things people always say to me is kids never pay that much attention. They're never that quiet. They're never that respectful. But this is an issue that affects kids' lives every single day. And they get the issue and they want to know what to do. They want to know how to handle this. And so I give suggestions on dealing with harassment. I give suggestions on being going from being a bystander to an upstander and standing up when things are happening. But also giving examples of kids who have changed their whole schools because of one kid deciding they're going to make a difference and change things. Because I don't think kids get that. I think kids feel powerless a lot of times in these situations.
You're listening to Newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, I'm Maureen McCollum. My guest today is Jamie Nabuzny, a safe school advocate. Jamie, you've traveled around to many school districts in Wisconsin. Are you impressed when one does call you and does reach out to you and asks you to come talk with the students? Do you think maybe school districts in the area are becoming to be more forward-thinking in regards to bullying or LGBTQ issues?
I think they're being forced to deal with the issue of,
really?
Of bullying and harassment, and particularly about LGBT issues. And I think part of the reason is that kids are making them deal with this. I've been in schools where kids actually have a meeting with the principal and say, these are the issues that are happening in our school. These are the teachers that are standing by and letting this stuff happen to us. These are the teachers that are actually hostily saying things about gay and lesbians in their classrooms, and we want it to stop. And principals sometimes are caught off guard, but a lot of times they want to do the right thing. They're just not aware of these things. And bringing them that awareness, a lot of – I mean, I met one of the principals, and I won't say what school, who said to me he really appreciated me coming in because it's given him a whole different way of looking at this. Like, he didn't realize how bad the problems were in his school. He said his kids don't tell him. Like, he hears about isolated incidents, but he didn't realize how large of a problem this was until my presentation. And so I think that schools are paying more attention, and I think part of the reason – I do think there has been a shift in the last 20 years since everything that happened to me, and the big shift has been – when I was in school, politicians weren't discussing gay and lesbian, bisexual, transgender rights. We weren't having conversations in our churches. We weren't having conversations in our homes typically about these issues. And now they're everywhere. Everywhere I go, everywhere I turn, every time I turn the radio on, the TV on, I'm hearing people debate whether or not I have the right to exist, whether I have the right to marry, whether I should have the right to have children. And I think that this is carrying over into the school. We're asking kids to go to school and be respectful of each other, and as adults, we're not being very respectful. And ultimately, this comes down to an environmental issue. Kids aren't going to school and learning how to be bigots. They're learning how to be bigots, and then they're going to school, and schools are having to deal with this issue. And because younger and younger kids are coming out, schools are dealing with these issues, and they're saying, wait a minute, we are a public school. We have to educate all of our kids. We have to figure out how to do it in a way that's respectful to everybody, that everybody, you know, can move forward and on this issue, and that kids can ultimately be safe and learn, because that's what they're in school to do. And I think that's why schools are taking this issue. And I will be honest, I'm surprised at how much opportunity I'm getting in rural areas. I've spent a lot of time in southwestern Wisconsin here, not what I would have expected when I started this. But I think it's great, and I think the fact that these schools should be applauded for taking this issue head on and saying, we're going to deal with this, because this is reality.
And I'm assuming you get feedback from maybe students or other administrators. You talked about the one principal. What other feedback do you get after you've visited? Do you keep up with the schools, and do you find out if things are getting better?
The best thing about what I'm doing now is Facebook, I'll be honest. I used to go to schools when I would speak, you know, 12 years ago, and I would leave and I'd never know what the impact was. I'd never know if things changed. And now I get messages the same day. I'm sure if I turned on Facebook right now, I'd have probably 40 messages from kids who heard me speak today in the schools. And by this evening, it'll probably be 100. And then tomorrow, I'll probably have another 100. And I think it's a wonderful opportunity for me to keep track of things and then follow up. And I hear things all the time like that, you know, kids are paying more attention to this. And typically, it's right after I spoke that kids are, you know, standing up. But I think it has a long-term effect as well. I hear from students who I spoke at their schools last year and how much better things are, how much more the teachers are taking this seriously or the principals. And so I do think that it works, but bringing a speaker in for a one-time thing isn't enough. The schools need to have ongoing dialogue. The kids need to be involved in that dialogue. Kids know who's being bullied, who's doing it, where it's happening, when it's happening, and how it's happening. Most people in schools, teachers, administrators, guidance counselors, have pieces of that puzzle. And if you want to solve the issue, you need all those pieces together. And then you need input from the kids who are on the front lines, who know what's happening. One school that I visited, their kids decided that they were going to monitor their Facebook accounts of all of the kids in the school and to reduce cyberbullying after there was a young woman who killed herself. And it came out afterwards, there was a lot of cyberbullying, and a lot of the teachers were, you know, thought this wasn't going to work. They didn't have faith in this. And these kids single-handedly got on Facebook, monitored their classmates, what they were saying. And not only did they reduce the bullying and harassment, but negativity in general. Kids say things all the time like, I'm stupid, or I'm really fat, or whatever the case may be. And then these kids would say, no, you're not. You know, you're one of the smartest kids in the school. What are you talking about? And that kind of impact, kids can change things. But I don't think if you put 100 teachers in a room and said, how are we going to stop cyberbullying, they wouldn't have had a clue. And half of them couldn't have monitored Facebook if you asked them to. You know, they wouldn't have an account. They wouldn't know how to do it. But kids know these answers, and they are out there changing things. They're out there making their schools a better place.
And when you said they've been monitoring, is that how they would monitor, is through positive reinforcement?
Absolutely. I asked them, I said, well, are you going to report everything to the principal? And they said, no, we're going to take care of it. When somebody harasses somebody, we're going to say, that's not okay. We're going to report it to Facebook, and we're going to stop it right there. And I was amazed by that. And I also was amazed by the fact that it worked. I mean, I ended up following up with the guidance counselor a few weeks later, and she said it's been amazing that a lot of schools refer to Monday morning as Cyber Monday, because all of the stuff that happens over the internet all weekend long spills over into the school, and the school then has to deal with all these issues on Monday morning. And she said Monday mornings are now filled with learning again, instead of having to deal with all of these issues and all these crises that develop from what happens on the internet. That's a huge change.
You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. My guest today is Jamie Nabuzny, a safe school advocate. And with that lawsuit, Jamie, that every school district needed to require a safe environment, a safe learning environment for children, what happens if they don't?
Well, if they don't, the principals of the school, the administrators of the school are personally held liable. And what that means is that they could actually lose their houses, they could lose savings accounts, because that personal liability is just that. And I think, and people say, well, isn't that a bad thing? And I say, no, most people would do the right thing, and so they don't have to worry about this. But ultimately, it comes down to, I mean, if somebody actually tries to protect a kid and does the right thing, they're not going to have to worry about it. It's for extreme situations like my situation, where principals looked the other way and they basically said, we're not going to do anything, and they gave a green light. I mean, my middle school principal said in front of kids that were harassing me, and she said this to my parents at a meeting, that if I was going to be openly gay, I had to expect these kind of things to happen. Basically giving this green light to these kids that they could do whatever they want, and she wasn't going to do anything about it. And I do think that something that is changing, and I think it is changing slowly, but it's changing, in a positive way, was that we now have the moral upper ground on this issue. I think we always have, but I think for so long people were afraid to assert that upper ground. And now the fact is that we do have kids in middle schools coming out. We have kids in high schools are coming out. And we need to talk about making the school a safe place for them, but giving them the information that they need, but also that their classmates need, to talk about issues not just of GLBT diversity but all kinds of diversity. And I think for a long time schools have been reluctant to do this, especially in small towns where they have a majority white population. They don't want to rock the boat. They kind of ignore these issues. They say, oh, we don't have an issue with racism. We don't have an issue with homophobia. Our school's okay. Well, the reality is they're having to confront these issues head on with the diversity that's happening with different races, different religions coming into the school, and then also kids coming out at a younger and younger age.
It seems like bullying has been getting more attention in the media lately. Do you think it's because it's just basic human evolution, or is it because people are finally being held accountable for their actions?
According to statistics, bullying hasn't increased and neither have suicides. But what's increased is people are paying attention to these issues. And I think what happened in the fall of 2010 was all of a sudden people started paying attention to these issues and saying, wait a minute. And I think part of that is the advent of the internet. And all of a sudden kids are, you know, people are reading their Facebook pages after the fact and saying, wait, they were being harassed or bullied. I remember when I was a child, there was a young person that killed themselves in my town and I was a kid and we never knew what happened. When I became an adult, I found out from one of his siblings who was then an adult that he killed himself because he was gay. Well, back then people swept that under the rug. The family would never talk about it. They wouldn't want to deal with it. And now I think it's too hard for them not to. It's on the internet. It's everywhere. They have to acknowledge the fact that that was part of it. But I think as we move forward and we're dealing with this issue, I think that 2010, both for bullying but also for GLBT rights, will be a pivotal moment. And the reason I say that is I think that for the majority of the country, they don't really care about gay rights. They don't really care what's happening. And I think that all of a sudden what happened was they might not care about the military. They may not care about marriage. But they can't sit there and turn on their TVs and say they don't care about kids in schools killing themselves because people are harassing them because of who they are. And I think in the same way that the media changed the civil rights movement by documenting and showing people on the nightly news what was happening, how these people were nonviolently protesting, being attacked with dogs, being attacked with water hoses, all of a sudden people got up and said, wait a minute, this isn't okay. This isn't America. This isn't the country I want to live in. And it changed things. And I think we're seeing that change. We're seeing now a majority of Americans believing that gay marriage is okay. We're seeing what we saw, the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. We're seeing a lot of progress in this, but because of that progress, there's the backlash, and that's spilling over into our schools.
Jamie Nabosny successfully sued the Ashland, Wisconsin school district in the mid-90s for the bullying he was subjected to. The first-of-its-kind lawsuit helped make school administrators more accountable for school bullying. I talked with him when he was in La Crosse last spring. Next week on Newsmakers, we'll talk with the candidates in the Republican primary for the 94th Assembly District. Kevin Hintz and Bruce Evers will square off on August 14th. Submit your questions for the candidates on our website at wpr.org/lacrosse. Thanks for listening to Newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, I'm Maureen McCollum. Our production team includes John Gatto, Steve Roysom, Mary Meehan Strube, and our senior news editor and producer, John Davis. To hear archives of this or other recent editions of Newsmakers, visit our website at wpr.org/lacrosse. In addition to Newsmakers, you'll find archived reports and special series produced by the La Crosse News Bureau. And if you'd like to make a comment on this week's Newsmakers or have a suggestion for future shows, you'll also find links to our producers and staff. That and more at wpr.org/lacrosse. Newsmakers is also on Facebook. Updates on future shows, links to our archives, and more. Like us at WPR Newsmakers on Facebook.